Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. My name's Ned Bolting.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Laura Laker.
Now, we've got a special guest who I'm going to introduce pretty much straight away. And the topic for this discussion on this particular podcast is as follows: advertising. It's everywhere. And while most people think it doesn't affect them, research shows it undoubtedly impacts the decisions we make. Otherwise, they wouldn't bother doing it, would they? Tobacco advertising has been banned. Will car advertising eventually become the new smoking? Well, to discuss that this week, we have, and other things, Leo Murray from Possible. And we're going to jump right in with him to discuss the topic. Just for a bit of background, Possible has co-authored two recent reports that you might be aware of if you've been paying attention recently on SUVs and car advertising. Smoking Out the Climate, that was about lessons from the advertising ban on tobacco for tackling the climate emergency, published in August 2020, and also Mind Games on Wheels, all about how advertising sold false promises of safety and superiority in SUVs. And that was published very recently, in fact, in April 2021. So welcome, Leo. Thanks very much for joining us. I know that you've been doing the rounds in media today, which is something we might be able to talk about a little bit later. But just to kick things off, tell us about Possible. And who you are exactly and how you got involved and how it all got started.
Thanks, Ned. Yeah, great to be on the show. I'm a huge fan. So it's nice to be here. True story. So I'm Leo Murray. I am Director of Innovation at the climate change charity Possible, which I also helped to co-found. It used to be called 1010. So for a long time, we were called 1010 Climate Action. And it started as a partnership with The Guardian off the back of a film. It was the almost the last thing Pete Postlethwaite did before he died. It's called The Age of Stupid. That was a film about a kind of apocalyptic future where everything had been ruined by climate change. And Pete Postlethwaite, last man standing, looking back at footage from the turn of the century, saying, why did we not do anything about this problem when we knew about it and we had a chance? So 1010 was originally just about cutting 10% of our emissions in 2010. And it was in the run-up, we launched it in the run-up to the Copenhagen Climate Conference, which, you know, some listeners would be old enough to remember, Copenhagen and all of that. And that was kind of the high watermark of certainly British public concern about climate change until Greta and Extinction Rebellion. 10 years later. So the point of Possible, what do we do? It's what makes us different, I suppose, from peers in the environmental NGO sector is that we try to stay positive. And in particular, it's positive practical action. So we try to get people together to actually do something about climate change rather than just complain about it. So it's not like we don't ever do a petition, but, you know, I guess a lot of what my peers in the sector do is sort of professional complaining. And you know, there is a lot of that. It's very well served, I guess, you know, trying to make people angry about climate change or the things that the government are not doing about it. And mostly we try to get people inspired about how the world would be a better place if we did something about climate change and actually offer people practical opportunities to do stuff about it. So we have a program which has recently launched called Car Free Cities, which is looking at, you know, the imperative in our climate change targets. When you look at what needs to happen in terms of reduction in vehicle miles driven in the UK, the implications of that, that won't be evenly distributed, the amount we need to reduce those miles. And it makes sense to focus on cities. Most of us live in cities. And it never made sense, even if climate change wasn't a thing, you wouldn't want everybody driving around in single occupancy private vehicles in cities anyway, because it makes them worse places to live. So that's you know, we've got that whole program. And then the Badvertising project, which you were just talking about, our partnership with the New Weather Institute, is a separate project, but it, of course, there's an awful lot of overlap. And what we are doing there, it's a bit of a departure for us, actually, because it is a bit of a no campaign, I guess. You know, what we're saying is, you know, we work on behaviour change if possible. And actually, though, people, practitioners in behaviour change will know that it's no good just asking somebody to change their routine habits without changing the choice architecture within which those decisions are made. And so that applies to hard things like infrastructure. So, you know, I think I've heard Ian Walker speak about this on this podcast. You know, the strongest determinant of whether somebody cycles to work is not their attitudes on the environment or any demographic information. It's not income or gender. It's just, is there a cycle lane or isn't there a cycle lane? If there's a cycle lane, people are much more likely to cycle to work. So hard stuff is very important for choice architecture, but actually so is the soft stuff as well. So is the cultural water in which we swim. And advertising dominates cultural output and is really undifferentiated in terms of, you know, there are no curbs on advertising things which are extremely carbon intensive. And that's what our campaign is seeking to introduce, because we have public policy goals around climate change. Everybody agrees these are very important. Meanwhile, we have a multi-billion pound industry which is pushing us to do things which we know we need to do less of. And it's very, very difficult to make progress on behaviour change, getting people to behave in ways that are more consistent with tackling climate change. Mm. When you're swimming against that tide, you know, that huge tide.
Yeah. Before I became a journalist, I was studying to be a dietitian. And one thing that I learned, and one thing that kind of pulled me away from dietetics and towards kind of cycling, was that you can tell people all you like what they need to be doing for their health and whatever. But actually, if you're not changing the environment or you're not kind of supporting them to make those changes, then people's habits are ingrained, and it really is the kind of little things that make a difference. But in order to make that happen, it helps.
Exactly. What's on the menu? You know, when I was growing up, there were no vegan options. There were no vegan sandwiches, right? I grew up, I was turned vegetarian as a child, and I just knew, there were two sandwiches I could eat. It was the egg mayonnaise sandwich and the cheese sandwich. And that's what was on all the sandwich shelves. So there was no vegan option. So you couldn't
like
couldn't
that in places.
Be vegan. Yes,
yeah,
many places.
Let's be honest, the whole confusion between vegans and Vulcans only got cleared up about 8 or 10 years ago in this country. Prior to that, nobody understood.
Live long and prosper.
Exactly.
Leah, how entrenched is all of this? And I kind of, like, my little, it's not an anecdote, but something that someone told me and always sort of stuck with me is back when motor cars became popular. Originally, the kind of motor lobbyists managed to persuade the US authorities to make jaywalking a crime. And Jay was, you know, a slur, sort of meant dirty hillbilly, effectively. It wasn't a nice thing to call somebody. So to call a jaywalker, you know, is demonizing pedestrians. So even then, you know, there was being smart enough to try and make sure that the car had sort of, you know, unfiltered access to all of our lives. What are we up against in terms of the size of the industry and how entrenched this is in our lives?
Oh, well, I mean, it literally dominates cultural output. So in terms of sort of cultural texts, so film produced, you know, artwork, design work, cultural output is mostly advertising today. So my career, you know, I got into this climate change campaigning originally through activism, but my previous career was an animator. That's what I'm trained to do. And I worked as an animator in Soho for a few years. And mostly what I did was make adverts. And I stopped doing it because I couldn't square what I knew about climate change with what I was going to work to do every day. You know, if you look at just the auto industry spends over $1 billion in the UK each year pushing cars at us. And, you know, everybody, your listeners will know, and, you know, everybody in this conversation knows that we need people to use cars less, buy cars less. You know, we need fewer cars being sold in the UK. So being up against that, over $1 billion, you know, $1.2 billion, that's 2018. That's our most recent count. You know, what do you do against that? Even a public information, you know, a big public information campaign from the government urging people not to buy cars, which of course they're not doing, would still come in at only a fraction of that kind of spend. So, you know, this is a problem that is very broad. And I think it kind of goes to the heart of the issue, the climate change issue in general, which is fundamentally about overconsumption in rich nations. And when I say overconsumption, I mean, you know, people consuming a lot more material, goods, resources, energy than they need to meet their needs and even meet wants around their own well-being and life satisfaction. And so advertising is, you know, is a key engine that drives that overconsumption, and in particular, very carbon intensive products and services. So things like SUVs, flights, and fossil fuels themselves. It's really clear that allowing these things to be pushed marketed aggressively to consumers at the same time as consumers are being asked to make changes in their lives, which are more consistent with reducing emissions. This doesn't make any sense. You know, we're pulling people in two different directions at once.
And you've compared this to the one of your reports compared kind of car advertising to smoking advertising, tobacco advertising. And it's amazing looking through your report. I think back in the 80s, the Radio Times started stopping advertising tobacco. And it was sort of, it took 20 years for everyone else to catch up. Well, no, 10 years, for 10, 15 years for everyone else to catch up. And it really kind of wasn't an uphill struggle, but it did start to crack the the case, isn't it? Because there's no way that anyone else has the kind of money of the car industry to counter those advertisements. I mean, every time you go to the cinema, remember the cinema, it's just like, it's just car advertising, isn't it? It's incredible. I'm always like, oh,
and then you watch the films and then you watch the films with the cars in.
Oh yeah. And then like the guy on the bike is kind of the weirdo. I saw a film recently. I don't even want to tell you what the guy was, but he's like coming into the scene with like a helmet and you're like, this guy is really like, it's like a very dodgy character.
It's like, yeah, do you remember National Lampoon's European Vacation and Chevy Chase knocks over, Chevy Chase is driving a car badly in the UK because he's American, so he doesn't understand left and right and all that sort of thing. And I think it's that film when he knocks Eric Idle off his bike, doesn't he?
No.
And of course, Eric Idle being British, plays to all those cliches, gets up and apologises, you know. So, yeah, you're right. The cyclist is always the klutz. That's very true.
Yeah,
that's very true.
It's a very common trope.
But I remember when the tobacco industry was kind of trying to wriggle out of the ban on advertising, and it used to claim, I don't think I've made this up, that it wasn't so much about, you know, their campaigns weren't so much about persuading new smokers to take it up. They were about protecting their share of the market against rivals.
Yes.
And I presume the car industry would argue the same thing. So Ford would say, we're not persuading people to drive cars, we're persuading people not to buy Renaults and to buy Fords instead.
Well, that's absolutely right, Ned. So that was the story that the industry were telling about it. Now, of course, what happened after the tobacco ban was introduced was that there were very many fewer new smokers being created. So it was effective at solving a problem which the industry said didn't exist. So when you look at the comparison today, so it's very interesting because we published that report in summer last year, our first report, highlighting that there was a problem here. And what then happened was both industries responded. So the car industry responded and so did the advertising industry. And they said a sort of range of incoherent things about why our campaign was a terrible idea and it wouldn't work. And the auto industry said, oh, advertising has nothing to do with it. You know, people buy the cars that they need and advertising is irrelevant. And the advertising agency said, the Advertising Association, this is what they said was both that a ban on advertising SUVs would be ineffective, but also that the right solution was a massive public information campaign, which they would be very happy to help with, to persuade people to live greener lifestyles, right? So the solution, basically banning advertising SUV ads, that won't work. But if you give us a lot more money, we'll run a public information campaign to tell people not to buy them. I mean, just pretty wild stuff. So I think it's worth us saying, you know, that campaign, the advertising campaign, is about kind of problematizing advertising and kind of bringing to the fore its role, which is largely invisible in driving the environmental crisis that we're facing. And we alighted on SUVs because there is such a simple story to tell there. So where, you know, what the auto industry said, the SMMT, when we launched this campaign, they just said, SUVs are just popular. People want to buy SUVs. And, you know, there's this sort of narrative that advertising just passively reflects consumer demand, so trends in consumer demand.
But actually, they're kind of aggressively advertising these things, aren't they? Your report said something like 66% of Ford's advertising in 2018 was for SUVs.
Yes.
In car advertising. They're really kind of pushing these vehicles and then claiming that it's...
There's a really good example that gives the lie to that, right? Because the Ford Fiesta is one of the most popular cars ever made. In the UK, it's still the most popular new car. And last year, 49,000 Ford Fiestas were sold. It's consistently highest selling car of the decade. And back in sort of 2014, 2015, it was also an extremely popular car in the United States. But it's not profitable for Ford. So last year, 2019, Ford discontinued the Ford Fiesta in the United States. Now, that wasn't because it was an unpopular car with consumers. It was because it was an unprofitable car. They just don't make enough money on each unit, whereas their SUVs and their pickup trucks make them $10,000 a pop. And so from an amoral corporate perspective, it makes sense for you to shift your marketing spend away from your unprofitable product lines and towards your profitable product lines. But it just so happens that the profitable product lines are much larger, more dangerous, and much, much more polluting vehicles. And so that is, you know, you can trace this. It's really clear. So between 2016 and 2018, Ford completely switched up its marketing spend so that it's now 85% of their marketing spend in the US is on SUVs and pickup trucks. So it's super clear. You know, you just walk through this process and you can see how advertising is being used to accelerate demand for these dirty vehicles. You know, there's really obvious, their fingerprints are all over it.
And they're not even being used kind of off-road, are they? I actually had two Ford Fiestas, Mark 1 and Mark 2. Back in the day. They were very old at the time. But yeah, I mean, we used to take them off road. I would take them to all sorts of places. And you didn't need a 4x4 when I were a lad.
That should be Ford's latest advertising campaign. You should be the ambassador.
Yeah.
Just saying you don't need a 4x4. I used to have a Ford Fiesta.
I've got a confession to make. Last weekend I had to make an essential journey to Newcastle and I had to do it by car because I had to get around. So I had to hire a car. And I went to collect it. There's a depot, a hire company about a mile up the road. I went to collect it on my Brompton And I happen to be wearing my hoodie that I ordered from New York that says that says
the war on
the
cars,
war on cars from the podcast.
Brilliant, yeah.
So I had a hoodie that said the war on cars on it, and I turned up on a Brompton to collect my car that I'd booked, and they'd run out of the standard little compact car that I'd ordered, and so I got a free upgrade, and the only car that I could pick up that day was an SUV. So I've just been driving one up and down the A1M. So I kind of have to disqualify myself from this conversation, except to say this, and I think I said this on an earlier episode a while ago, that one of my big kind of issues with this is that they are horribly well designed. I mean, they are, you know, they are the if you like, the cockpit design, the kind of sense of comfort and easement and kind of like control
they're
and power
that
you
on
have.
Wheels, aren't they?
It's phenomenal. I only occasionally hire cars, and by definition, they're always brand new, and it always shocks me how amazing a brand new car is, kind of thing. And it appeals to the very worst in me. And it's quite hard not to crack that, isn't it? Because, you know, unlike tobacco and cigarettes, it's pretty hard to stand that one up ultimately, wasn't it? So why do you carry on smoking? Oh, well, with SUVs, you know, you're always going to have people saying, but they're an amazing tool. I need this thing in my life, you know. It's a tough one.
I mean, that response that we got from the industry saying, well, people just buy the cars that they need, you know, and who are you to tell people what cars are? You don't know what's going on in people's lives. That was the sort of attitude. And so one of the things that we did in response to that was get the DFT to break down the sales figures for SUVs in the UK. And what we found was 76% of SUVs that were sold in the UK last year were registered to urban addresses. And even right, so there is a question, what is an SUV? Because it's a bit of a woolly, you know, it's a slippery fish, actually, an SUV. I'll come back to that. But even for large SUVs, which have four-wheel drives, have actual off-road capability, it's still two-thirds of those are registered to urban addresses, right? So Kensington and Chelsea is indeed the capital. It's the Range Rover capital of Britain. One in every 10 new cars sold in Kensington and Chelsea, or bought in Kensington and Chelsea, is a Range Rover. And 36% of them are large SUVs. And there are no off-roading opportunities in West London. I live in West London. You know, we've had Tony Devenish, who I know you're all familiar with. Tony Devenish, in the last couple of weeks, has come out saying that West Londoners need these vehicles. Basically, he seemed to be saying because they've got second homes in the countryside. That was the argument that he made.
Yeah. If I can do it in my Fiesta, then you don't need... Because that was one of the four, there were like, you identified like four things that the SUV advertisers were kind of selling to people, and it was like get back to nature was one, dominate the road was two, help the environment was three, and protect your family was four. And the only real one that they were actually doing was dominating the road.
Exactly,
and the others
right.
weren't really, like, they're not safer, people don't really go on like cool adventures in them, and they don't help the environment.
They've never used off-road, they certainly don't help the environment. And I think you've written about how they are not any safer, right?
Yeah.
So that's a really part of the message and psychology of SUVs, what's being sold to people, you know, and why you see so many mums driving around in them in West London. You know, it's a really core part of it, is keep your family safe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the irony there is that actually SUVs originally had quite a niche appeal. So
it stands for sports utility vehicle.
It does. It stands for sports utility vehicle. And, you know,
badminton and... badminton.
You're not thinking of the right sport.
Driving to the desert. You can't play badminton.
What have they got to do with sports?
So originally, you know, their heritage is they are military vehicles originally, and then they sort of migrated onto farms and back again. So it's, you know, it's worth reading the whole Mind Games on Wheels report, which goes through the history of the evolution of an SUV and how they came to be sold to ordinary families living in cities to do their shopping. The message about dominate the road and keep your family safe, you're not any safer in an SUV. You're in more danger. So you're more likely to die in a crash than a a passenger in another car. But you are much more likely to kill a pedestrian. And so other road users are endangered by the rise in SUVs, right? So objectively, they make the roads a more dangerous place for other road, particularly vulnerable road users, but also people in other cars. And so that's created a bit of an arms race. So although originally SUVs were marketed to quite a small niche of people who were really into kind of macho military style vehicles, part of the way that the appeal is spread is by just, it's an arms race on the roads. It doesn't feel safe to be driving around in a little Ford Fiesta when you've got whopping great trucks.
Well, it's like that little graphic that always does around on the internet, which is, you know, Timmy would like to walk to school, but there's too many cars, so we drive him instead. And it's that thing where we all have to then end up in this arms race to protect ourselves against other larger vehicles. And the larger the vehicle you have, the more ownership you feel of the road. In terms of, Leo, in terms of the Mind Games report, Mind Games on Wheels, we talked a lot about the climate, which is obviously one part of it. But just in terms of, you know, every day, we talked a little bit about pedestrian safety there. In terms of, even if you weren't interested in the climate, we should all be interested in the climate. But let's say we weren't. When it comes to, you know, what our cities are like, when it comes to active travel and all of these and congestion, which affects, you know, congestion causes air pollution and climate change, but it's annoying as well to a lot of people. What does the auto industry kind of, what are the falsehoods that they advertise? I always see the adverts where the cities have no other cars in them. That always cracks me up. But what are the other tactics that I guess are conning us?
So it's actually unusual for them to even use a city, you know. So SUV adverts typically show the SUV on an open road in the countryside somewhere, and very often in sort of some rugged mountainous terrain, you know, on a coastal road or at the top of a mountain driving through the desert. You know, it's mostly natural settings. When they do depict cities, like you say, they are cities that are completely devoid of other cars and usually devoid of other people as well. So, you know, the imagery of this stuff is actually, originally it's shot through violence. So that's a really consistent theme in the early SUV ads. And a brilliant one from Britain for Range Rovers. I'm not going to forget the catchphrase now, but it's... double barreled. SUVs. It's not SUVs. Range Rovers are for the only choice for the double barreled. And it's a picture of a landed gentry with a shotgun on a chute. You know, double meaning, posh and armed. That's who they were originally targeting those vehicles at. but the. You know, the safety thing has kind of emerged. I would say of the different psychological themes that are played up in this stuff, the safety theme, and because unlike the other aspects, you know, so the freedom thing and escape to nature it contains the seeds of its own downfall, right? So the more successful you are at selling these things to people, the less it becomes possible to escape to nature, right? To escape from other cars, because wherever you go, there's a load of cars there already. There's a load of SUVs there. Whereas the dominate the road thing, you know, the more dangerous you make the road for other road users, the more likely they are then to, you know, so it sort of creates its own market, the SUV, by making it impossible to do other things. And I think, you know, your question about the kind of, you know, the other impacts that beyond emissions, one of the things that we did when we looked at the, you know, when we were first doing the categorization lookup tables from the European Environment Agency registration stats, was we looked at wheelbase. Now, what we found was 150,000 new cars were sold in the UK in 2019 that are physically too large to fit in a standard parking space. Now that is something, you know, it will be familiar to everyone. You can see it. Cars just sticking out, you know, cars that are too wide to open the doors if you just park in a car park and you've got parallel parking on either side of you. At a time when, you know, space is at a premium in our cities. So that's a kind of, you know, it was a bit of an aside, really. But we thought it would be an interesting thing to look at. And yeah, you know, adding 150,000 vehicles to the roads that don't fit in parking spaces, you know, what's happening is you've got local authorities who are going around repainting the lines and making their parking spaces bigger. Instead of thinking, hold on a minute, you know, it reminds me of that Lewis Mumford quote, which is actually about road building, you know, which is, it's like tackling obesity by adding another, you know, loosening your belt. It's, you know, it's the wrong approach. It's like, hold on a minute, you know, people haven't got bigger, you know, the people driving around these things.
We have, because we've been sat in SUVs actually.
Yeah. Well, there is that, but yeah, we're not carrying more stuff or anything, you know.
One of the reasons, I mean, the reason why they're so dangerous, in case more, much more dangerous for pedestrians than people on bikes, is that their fronts are higher, isn't it? And so you're more likely to get the vital organs than the lower limb hit someone. And that's kind of.
Particularly children.
Yeah.
Because, you know, particularly children are much, much more likely to die in a collision. And,
episode of Top Gear years and years ago, where they managed to fit 15 school children behind a Range Rover without it being visible in any of the mirrors. Like, it's just nuts. It's just nuts.
Yeah. And it kind of feel you, I mean, where I live, the roads can be quite narrow residential roads, and already the cars kind of hang over the middle line when people are driving towards you. And if you're cycling, it's even more scary when it's like this massive thing. And out in the countryside on a weekend ride, it just feels like, it feels kind of much more dangerous. So you've kind of suggested ways that we can tackle this as a society. But I mean, I guess it's not gonna happen overnight. But you in your report, you're calling for an end to SUV advertising and for ad agencies to reject taking work from. I mean, we're probably talking about billions of pounds of advertising revenue.
That's the difficulty is that it's a lot of people are paid not to understand this stuff, you know. I think that you know, there are a lot of problems, a lot of social negatives that fall out of the shift to large, more polluting vehicles. But when it comes to climate change, you know, we have legally binding targets on this, and you know, the International Energy Agency has flagged SUVs as a problem globally. It's not just in the UK, where they're now over 40% of sales. It's in every major car market in the world. And the shift to SUVs is responsible for the second largest increase in emissions over the last few years after the power generation sector. So in the UK, since 2016, the average CO2 emissions from a new car sold have been rising. They were falling until 2016 because of vehicle fuel efficiency standards, at which point they started to rise again. And the motor industry were like, oh, this is because people switch from diesel to petrol. But actually, when you look at the data, that's not true. It's because people have been switching to SUVs at this ridiculous rate. So 2019, well, the 4 years running up to 2019, 37 SUVs were sold in the UK for every electric vehicle. And so it's pretty clear that, you know, this is pushing us in the opposite direction from where we need to go. Transport emissions have not fallen at all in the UK since 1990. So we think that there's a really clear imperative here. And actually, this is relatively speaking, this is quite a light touch solution to it, because what we're calling for is for the dirtiest third of vehicles to no longer be allowed to be advertised in the UK. So we're supposed to be averaging 95 grams of CO2 per kilometre for new cars sold in the UK now. That's across the EU, but we're aligned in the UK. And a lot of these SUVs are clocking more than 200, right? So we framed this around SUVs, because that is a popularly understood category. Now, we've had a lot of people, you know, car nerds, angrily saying, I've got an electric SUV and things like this. But the truth is, when you look at the figures, if you look at the top 10 most polluting vehicles that are for sale in the UK, the top 10% of the most polluting, and then you look at those by sales volume, all of the actually popular cars, the cars that are causing the problem, they're all SUVs, right? So all 10 of the top 10 most polluting cars by sales volume are SUVs. And so this would have the effect, banning the dirtiest third would have the effect of banning basically all large SUV adverts.
Do you think that the government might just say in the kind of free market that we have that this problem, you know, this problem will, I don't agree with it, but this problem will solve itself. And then does that link, because people's habits will change in the same way that SUVs have made change their habit once. I do think, you know, EVs are growing in sales considerably. And my general awareness has been much higher in my local area about people driving EVs. So, you know, people are going to start to promote EVs using car advertising, the same techniques, the same tactics. And then what problem will that cause? Because, you know, for when I get overtaken by a massive Tesla, it's still massive. It's still, you know, it's still going to kill me if I'm a pedestrian.
Yeah.
And also it's still got however many tons of, you know, embedded carbon in manufacture. So, you know, how dangerous is this kind of sleepwalk into the system will solve itself? And I know that you sit on some Department for Transport kind of panels and talk about this. Like, what, you know, do we think that this is going to be the next problem, just electric vehicles and electric SUV advertising?
Yeah, so I think there's kind of two questions there. One is around, are electric SUVs, is that a good solution to the problem that we've identified? And the answer is no. Because yes, okay, the CO2 emissions at the point of use, they're gone. But these vehicles are much heavier. So an electric SUV is a lot heavier than the regular SUV. That increases tire wear and road wear. And of course, that's where most of the particulate pollution actually comes from. And so it doesn't make that problem go away. Actually, they're heavier vehicles, they're more likely to kill people when they do hit them as well. And so you're not going to see any improvement in pedestrian and cyclist casualties or you know, collisions between cars either. And actually, this is about resource efficiency. Ultimately, like a really big part of rising to the climate change challenge is about doing more with less. And that's not what an electric SUV is. You know, you have to remember that private cars in the UK spend over 95% of their time stationary. And so making an electric vehicle has higher embedded emissions than making a fossil fueled vehicle. So in manufacture, it's significantly more tons of carbon are emitted to produce an asset that is then spends, you know, 95% of its time stationary doing nothing at all. And so that's, electric SUVs are not a good idea because it's just an enormous amount of resource which is going into something which just doesn't need to happen. And then more broadly, the problem, the concern about EVs when it comes to climate change is that people put all their eggs in one basket. You know, it looks superficially like a really attractive solution. If you're a politician and you're like, you want to minimize disruption, you want to minimize people complaining to you about doing things about climate change, then it just feels like a like for like, brilliant, you can just swap this in. Now, the first problem with that is a sort of stock and flow analysis, which is that from the point at which you stop selling petrol and diesel vehicles, and 100% of new cars being sold are electric vehicles, it will still take 20 odd years for 9 out of 10 cars on the road to be electric, right? Because that's how it works. So there's a very long tail. So you also need a large reduction. And in fact, in the run-up to stopping selling those cars, you need a large reduction in the vehicle miles being driven on the roads. And electric vehicles are cheaper to run. They're cheaper to run, they're cheaper to use. And so DFT models show the switch to EVs actually substantially increasing the vehicle miles driven. And of course, the road network's not getting any bigger and it's already at capacity, in many, many places and in particular in our cities. And so congestion is liable to massively worsen if our only strategy is switching to electric vehicles. And that's why, you know, fundamentally, that brings me back to like that Car Free Cities campaign that we have. It makes it, yes, we need electric vehicles. You know, we can't meet our climate change targets without switching to electric vehicles, but we need them in places where private motorised transport is realistically the only option. And that is, you know, rural places. Basically, it's places where you've got sparse population density, and you can't, and therefore you can't support like fixed infrastructure public transport. In cities, you just don't want any private cars at all. And, you know, if you take London, where I live, the mayoral transport strategy is for 80% of trips to be made by walking, cycling or public transport by 2041. In inner London, that figure is 90%. Now, it makes no sense in a scenario where you are you're doing everything you can to get people not to use their cars. Why have cars on the streets in inner London boroughs if we're not going to let people use them at all? Actually, what we should have is a bolder vision here, which is to completely eradicate private cars from certainly from inner London boroughs. We're a minority of people own cars and have access to cars in inner London boroughs today anyway.
So I'm just thinking about kind of what people can do, like how we can kind of solve the problem, just the four of us. Mm. Solve the SUV problem, solve the car advertising problem. We've got 10 minutes.
We could chip in like a tenner.
Yeah.
And then we could put an advert out saying don't buy SUVs.
I'll write it on the back of my rucksack for when I'm cycling. When we had places like the Radio Times, one of the pioneers of stopping cigarette advertising, does that kind of thing have an impact?
Yes.
And what is it? And can we ask the people that a lot of people are subscribers to news organizations now. Can we ask them? Is it reasonable to ask them, given advertising revenues for journalism is kind of...
Well, that's the, you know, yes.
That's a difficult one.
Some people do complain to us about that, you know, that journalism's already on its knees and, you know, relies on advertising revenue. But of course, you know, if you were to ban the car industry from advertising SUVs, it's not like they would stop spending money on advertising, right? They would be forced to advertise less polluting models. Now, when it comes to what can people do? So for a start, we have a petition open at the moment, which you can find on the badverts.org website, which will sit behind a letter that we will write to the DCMS ministers asking for this.
Department from Culture, Media and Sport.
Exactly. They're technically responsible for regulating advertising. And so be great to get as many names as possible on that. But, you know, at a more practical sort of, or a closer to home level, actually, there is a lot of advertising that is controlled by bodies that have a public service remit in some way. So in particular, passenger transport authorities. So Transport for London, but, you know, all over the UK, you have passenger transport authorities. They answer to city administrations and councillors. So they're ultimately democratically controlled. And they control a lot of advertising space. And so it really is incredibly perverse to see an SUV ad on a bus stop, right? But we've all seen it.
My favourite advert was in Euston Station, and it was in the underground, and it had a digital moving billboard for a Vauxhall Corsa, of all things, and it basically had, like, the scenario was cattle class, and there was loads of people in a train, and then it swished back, and there was a Vauxhall Corsa, and it said first class.
I remember this
is mental.
That's the sort of archetype. It makes no sense. And actually, councillors, you know, most local councillors of, you know, across the political spectrum are in it to help their neighbourhoods, and will recognise that there's a really clear mismatch here between public policy goals that they're pursuing in other ways, and then they're allowing this stuff to be promoted in spaces that they control. Now, many councillors don't know that they have any powers in this regard. And so that's what we've been finding as people have been writing to councillors. But there is a motion that has already passed first stage in Liverpool City Council to ban SUV ads and other high carbon advertising.
Are we talking billboards?
It's billboards and bus stops for the main part. Now, Transport for London obviously also has the London Underground network, and we will be taking this up with the new mayor after May To try to, you know, so TfL is a good example of a space where there is a lot of advertising that many, many people see every day that is controlled by a public body, and already there are curbs. So there's loads of precedent. TfL don't allow adverts from, for instance, companies that are headquartered in countries that have the death penalty for gay sex, you know. So that we've got social criteria for allowing or disallowing adverts in those kind of public realm spaces, out of home advertising, it's called. And so that's a really good place to start. So, you know, we've got a right to counselor action on the badverts.org website. It'll need a bit of rejigging after the elections, because that's how it works. But, you know, that is a really good place to start. And then writing to media outlets. Of course, The Guardian, we should give them a shout out now, because The Guardian have already banned fossil fuel adverts. They will not take adverts from oil companies anymore. They do take car ads.
Though.
That's right. They do take car ads. They do take flight ads. And they've defended that by saying, you know, we can't take the hit. But, you know, a lot of us get a lot of our climate change reporting, you know, through The Guardian. It is a sort of a jarring mismatch. And so I think it's only a matter of time.
Yeah. I was just going to say, sort of on a slightly more detailed and smaller level than those broad and very important things that you've sort of flagged up. But everybody, if they think about it in their own sphere of interests and associations, can probably find a way of, on a micro level, addressing this issue in their family, their group of friends, or even, you know, interacting with, I think with my kind of pro cycling hat on, it kind of still blows my mind that the best funded cycling team in the world is sponsored by a manufacturer of SUVs. And
I'm glad we've got onto that, actually. Let's talk about that for a minute, Ned, because that is, you know, so if you look at the history of tobacco advertising, when they got banned from advertising in general, the last refuge was sport. And suddenly sports a load of money came into sports sponsorship, you know, early Ecclestone and everything, or, you know, or all of that. And to some extent, although they haven't been banned from regular advertising, that's what you're seeing here. You know, you get the aura, that you know, the halo effect from being associated with athletes and sports brands, and it is particularly perverse and wrong.
Well, they did a photo shoot not so long ago. You know, they rolled out.
So embarrassing.
We're talking about, let's face it, we're talking about the Ineos Grenadiers. Let's name them. But they got a couple of the riders to kind of lean casually on the front of one of these Grenadiers, and kind of slightly ironically, they propped their bikes up against the front grill of this beast. And it just, all it did to my mind was just flag up just how dangerous they are to cyclists. It was kind of, you know, you just imagine the collision.
So they haven't, we've got no figures yet for the CO2 emissions per kilometre of the Grenadier, but you know, looking at the vehicle, I mean, it's going to be north of 200, isn't it?
Well, don't they produce petrochemicals as well? So, I mean,
they're
the Alpha and Omega. They've built their own virtuous circle there, haven't they?
I mean, not just petrochemicals, you know, Ineos are the frackmaster general in the UK. You know, they were the biggest advocates, biggest corporate advocates for the push for fracking in the UK, which, you know, only got defeated through a massive sort of popular uprising against it because people didn't want it. So it seems so wrong that the cycling teams.
Yeah, but all I can say is that, you know, they it's probably incumbent upon cycling fans who feel that way to make their feelings felt, you know, and that's a little thing that you can do quite clearly, and they probably would sit up eventually and take notice, I would imagine.
Leo, we've talked a lot about car advertising, but obviously you know so much about the perils of climate change. I think it'd be worth just asking you as we finish up to give us your view on the government's what's described as the radical new climate change commitments, which will set the UK on course to cut carbon emissions by 78% by 2035. What do you make of it? Do you think there's going to be enough action to make that actually happen? Give us your take.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, listen, my take is this is great. It is great. It's particularly great right now because for diplomatic reasons, we're hosting COP26 and the new Biden administration is going big on climate. And actually, if we didn't have Britain out there in front, you know, our commitments in the UK, Boris Johnson's commitments on this, are considerably more ambitious than Joe Biden's. And it's worth listeners understanding that, right? So, you know, we've got different baselines and things, but without the UK having kind of been an outlier and making these commitments over the last couple of years. So the last thing Theresa May did before leaving office was sign the net zero legislation. You know, that is her legacy. It's a fantastic legacy. Let's just gloss over everything else she did as prime minister. You know, it's a fantastic legacy to leave. And the UK making this commitment is just incredibly important diplomatically. Now, of course, the truth is our track record, you know, we don't have the policies in place to meet it, and we don't have the policies in place to meet our existing commitments that we already had, which we're already well off course for meeting. So it's also, I think, worth saying that although I like really welcome these, and you know, the new target is both world leading. Right. So it is a more ambitious target than any other major economy, major industrialized economy has. It's still not adequate. And so, you know, from sort of the climate justice campaign community will tell you that the UK's own targets, you know, our net zero by 2050 goal is not adequate. It's not sufficient. We're not doing our fair share when it comes to cutting emissions. But of course, you know, it's both things at the same time. It's both better than anything anyone else has put on the table and not good enough. We've got to welcome it at this point in time, because I think an important bit of context is it is a country mile better than the climate change commitments of any other right-wing government anywhere in the world, right? And this is a very right-wing government that we have. And it's terribly important that they are, you know, they're following the science.
Well, I would suggest we leave it there, because you've left us on a bit of an upbeat note, which is nice. The glass is either half empty, or indeed it's half full, or somewhere in between. But let's concentrate on the half full bit for now. Really interesting stuff, Leo. And I'm feeling really bad about my SUV that I hired. So I'm going to go away. Go away and reflect on myself and the damage I've done. needs must, unfortunately. Excellent. Listen, good luck. More strength to your arm. Keep it up. And, you know, I'd probably encourage everyone who's been listening and absorbing your words to try and get involved and sign the petition. And just remind us very briefly, Leo, where do they sign the petition? Where do they go to?
Badverts.org.
Badverts.org, folks. All right, brilliant. That's it for this episode. Thank you very much, Leo. You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate us and review us and share the podcast with anyone you think might enjoy it. Catch you all next time.
Bye.
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 Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.